Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a regular weekly program looking into the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, all of that. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. This program, like the last two, is a little different from our normal format. We usually have an opening of short updates, and then I respond to your questions, and then we have an interview or a more in-depth discussion. However, the last 2 weeks, and this is the third and final week of our little experiment, involves me in splitting the program into two halves and devoting the first half to an in-depth discussion and doing pretty much the same in the second. And I'm interested in your response. I'd like you to let me know if you get a chance through our websites whether you like this format, would like to see more of it, less of it, in terms of our normal format, to which we will return as the basic structure of the program in the last week of July. Having said that, let me remind you quickly what our websites are so that you can respond if you're so inclined. rdwolf with two Fs .com and Democracy at Work, that's all one word, Democracy at Work .info. Those are the two websites to use. We archive there every program we have ever produced, so you can listen to them at your leisure. We also provide all kinds of updates, video shows, lectures, interviews, you name it, to supplement and support what you hear on this program. It is a resource that is made available to you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, at no charge whatsoever. Please make use of it. The websites are also the way to communicate to us in general with questions, comments, criticisms, all of that. There are ways for you to sign up on our free newsletter, which we will send you at no cost, of course, that allows you to keep up with us. The websites also contain icons for Facebook and Twitter. Click on them and you can follow us in that way. Make use of the websites, in short, for all the ways they can be helpful. I also want to ask you and remind you that I travel around the country giving talks, and if you're interested in arranging something like that in your part of the country, please get in touch with us, again, through the websites. Finally, we are a growing family of radio stations, now over 45, and eager to grow much larger. We need your help. If you know someone at a local community or public or college or commercial radio station, we're open to all of them. Get us that information, that contact. We will follow up and get more folks involved in the community of those working to understand and change the economic system we all depend on. So, in today's first half program, I want to talk about something many, many of you have asked me to discuss in greater detail or have asked me questions about. And this has to do with what we call workers' self-directed enterprises. This is the fundamental alternative to a capitalist enterprise. And by capitalist enterprise, I mean simply your typical corporation owned by a few people who have the bulk of the shares. That's how we own corporations in the main. Those shareholders, with the few that dominate, elect a board of directors, one share, one vote. If you own a share, you get a vote. If you don't own shares, you get no votes. If you own most of the shares, you get most of the votes, and so you make the decisions. A tiny number of people, as everyone knows, make those decisions on who's on the board of directors. Typical capitalist corporation, the board of directors has 15 to 20 people, and they make all the key decisions by themselves. These include what the company is going to produce, what goods and services, what technology it's going to use, how it's going to carry out production, where the production will happen, in the North, in the South, in the United States, somewhere else, And finally, what to do with the profits. It may be that everybody, all the workers, who can number in the tens, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, they may all be affected by those decisions, but they are excluded from them. Only the board of directors, 15 to 20 people, make those decisions, and they are selected by the shareholders. The workers, typically in most corporations, do not own enough shares that they can make any difference whatsoever. A worker self-directed enterprise, in contrast, is completely different. What worker self-directed means is that all the workers in an enterprise, together, democratically, one worker, one vote, make the decisions. The workers decide collectively and democratically what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits that all of them, in their different ways, have helped to produce. So a worker self-directed enterprise, or if you like, a workers cooperative, is a radically different way of organizing the production of goods and services in our society from that of the capitalist model, which currently prevails. That's important to keep in mind. What are the arguments that we have given and that are generally given for why one ought to prefer a worker self-directed enterprise from a typical capitalist enterprise? In other words, what are the strengths of this worker self-directed enterprise that one would want to think about when comparing it to a capitalist enterprise? I'm focusing on the worker self-directed enterprise because we all live in, work for, and have studied and learned about capitalist enterprises all of our lives. It's the other one that needs to be elaborated and presented so we could finally get to the point of having an intelligent and informed discussion and debate in this country about them. So let's go through it. First, in a worker self-directed enterprise, every worker has two jobs and therefore two job descriptions. On the one hand, you do whatever the particular task is that the enterprise has you do. You build things, you sell things, you supervise, you whatever. But the second job every worker has is to be part of the decision-making apparatus. You might think of it this way. Your job is a particular task, and in addition, you are a member of the board of directors, because all workers are. That's what it means. And that means you are called upon not just to do your particular task with your particular skill and your particular experience, but you're also called upon to be a leader, to be a director, to make the big decisions for the future of the enterprise. You have, in short, to become a citizen of the community that makes any enterprise work. And that means we're going to develop new talents and new skills. You're going to be asked to master a variety of things. All kinds of capabilities inside you are going to get a chance to come out and show what they can do. We want your design capabilities, your foresight, your deliberation. We want all of that. You're not just a drone doing a task assigned to you by somebody else. You're part of who of the group that decides who does what and how it's all organized. We think that's better for your physical and mental health to have that diversity of job-related activities. Number two, if workers made the decision, the problem of jobs leaving the United States would come to an abrupt end. Why? Because if you put the question of closing the factory in Cincinnati or closing the office in Chicago to the workers involved in the enterprise, they would not vote to do that because that would be to destroy their jobs, to wreck the communities who depend on the taxes from these enterprises, and they're not going to do it. So the whole exodus of enterprises would have been drastically reduced, if not eliminated, if we had a economy based on worker self-directed enterprises. Next example, equally important, the environment, ecology. Today, if a technology is presented to a corporation about how they could make more of whatever they make more cheaply by using this technology, which unfortunately pollutes the air, pollutes the water, pollutes the soil, creates too much noise, whatever, a handful of people, that board of directors of the capitalist enterprise, they may very well decide they want that new technology because it enhances their profits. And they say to their workers, if you don't like the ecological damage it does, well, then go get another job or move or just absorb it. The people on the board of directors, being rich, have all kinds of ways to escape the ecological damage their choice of technology produces. So we get what we have in the United States and in many other capitalist countries, a woeful neglect and disrespect of the environment by people who want to put profits of enterprise ahead of saving the planet. Now compare that to a worker self-directed enterprise. They would be presented with this technology too. They would notice that it makes more profits, in which they have an interest. But at the same time, the workers know that the polluted air, water, soil, and noise is going to affect their health and the health and well-being of their spouses and of their children and of their neighbors and of their community. And here's one thing we can be sure of. Even if sometimes a worker self-directed enterprise might choose a polluting technology, much of the time they won't, because they won't want to suffer the consequences, and they can't escape because they're the workers, and they live there, and they can't move. And consequently, we will have a much more respectful decision around production in its effect on the environment if we had worker self-directed enterprises as compared to capitalist firms. Let me give you another example. We now allow the board of directors to decide how to distribute the profits. And therefore, we should not be surprised, although many of us seem to be, we should not be surprised when we discover that the boards of directors of corporations give a large part of the profits to the shareholders, that's called dividends, and another large part of the profits to themselves in sky-high executive CEO salary packages. That's what creates the growing inequality in our society. Capitalism does that by distributing the profits we all help to produce to a tiny number of people in disproportionate amounts. Now, suppose the distribution of the profits we all help to produce in our offices, factories, and stores were instead distributed by the democratic collective decision of all the workers. You think they would give a tiny number of themselves huge amounts of money while the rest of them can't pay for the kids' college education? It's not going to happen. You want to do something serious about the unequal distribution of income in capitalist societies? Then go from capitalism to worker self-directed enterprises. You'll get a much less unequal distribution. Finally, if workers democratically decided what happens to them on the job, it would be an enormous boost and support to workers participating in the democratic decisions around where they live. In other words, if you want greater political democracy, give it what it needs, namely the support of economic democracy. Or to say the same thing yet one more way, if you want to understand why political democracy is mostly a form and a shell, and that a small number of people call the tune in politics. It's because that small number are connected to, if not exactly the same as, the people who sit at the top of an undemocratic economic system. The folks with the money, that's right. The ones who dominate in economics because it's undemocratic, then do the same to our political democracy, making it a shell. Okay, last questions. Maybe well and good to have worker self-directed enterprises, but how are they going to coordinate with one another? How are you going to make sure that there aren't too many of them producing more shirts than we need, et cetera, et cetera? In other words, how do you organize an economy that way? Well, partly my answer is there are many ways to do that, and history provides those to us. For example, we could have a market system. That's right. Enterprises owned and operated democratically and collectively by their workers, could buy and sell from one another, could sell to the public in a market. Or we could have some planning, or we could have a very regulated market. We have lots of models to use, and they have pros and cons, and we will discuss and debate that. But setting up the coordination of these isn't a major problem, since we have a variety of mechanisms. We can combine them, we can adjust them. That is a problem that we can solve and will. To say this another way, capitalists, people who set up little enterprises, they don't worry about the coordination. That is, they focus on their enterprise. Then they go and they sell in a market. If you look at the history of capitalism, it has toyed with a variety, it has groped its way through trial and error as to how to coordinate. So some coordination is done by market buying and selling. Some coordination is done by arranging. Governments arrange, big corporations arrange for the movement of goods and services without buying and selling them inside the company or inside the government institution. So we have planned distributions, we have market exchanges. Capitalists found their way to construct the larger coordination systems, and worker self-directed enterprises can and would do the same. They might end up at a different place because of who they are, but this is not a problem that we need to imagine precludes moving in the direction of worker self-directed enterprises. Final question, often asked us, who will own these worker self-directed enterprises? Interesting question. And the answer is, like with capitalism, there will be a variety of ownerships. We will perhaps have individuals own them. We could, for example, say that particular individuals are given an ownership of an enterprise. We might work it this way. You get to be the owners of the enterprise. You have shares, perhaps, in the enterprise. But one thing that's not negotiable, which you as owners can't do, is you cannot change the worker self-directed nature of the enterprise. That is, you own it, but all the decisions are made by the workers together. They are the board of directors. You don't elect them. Your ownership doesn't give you that. And that should come as no surprise because, for example, today we allow private individuals to own a corporation. But if those people said, well, I own the corporation, therefore I own the workers, therefore I can have, I don't know, sexual access to the workers, we laugh at them and say, oh, no, no, you're an owner. But ownership doesn't give you that right. Well, in a worker self-directed enterprise, we do the same. You may be an owner. You may even get a cut of the profits because you're an owner. But worker self-directed enterprise, you can't touch that. That's not part of ownership. Or we could have the workers in an enterprise collectively own their own enterprise as well as be the directors of it. That would likely be a popular arrangement. Or we could have a local government do that, or a church do that, or a local community, or the national government. There's all kinds of arrangements of ownership of worker self-directed enterprises, just like there are all kinds of ownership in capitalist enterprises. This is not some major obstacle or problem that we need to worry somehow compromises the project or the possibilities of this arrangement. Okay. What then is the issue? If worker self-directed enterprises have these virtues, if worker self-directed enterprises can readily and easily solve the coordination problem, if they can solve in a variety of ways the ownership problem, well then the question is, why don't we have more of them? And many of you have posed that question, so I want to conclude a little bit with some comments on that question. So first, the answer is, we do in fact have them. We've always had them. Worker self-directed enterprises of one kind or another, often called worker cooperatives or communal enterprises or community enterprises, have existed more and less throughout the history of capitalism and indeed before capitalism. This has always been an option that people have found their way to, that has attracted interests of people. Let me give you a few examples. Religious orders, people who wanted to live a religious life as monks, as nuns, as members of the Society of Quakers, as the Shakers, for some of you who know American history, they often withdrew from regular participation in society into little communities where, among other things, they had to organize the production of goods and services that they needed to live on. Clothing, food, shelter, and so on. And guess what? Their religious commitments often led them to setting up production, you guessed it, in the manner of worker self-directed enterprises. Their religion said there shouldn't be a few people who make all the decisions. Work should be done collectively. Everybody should participate. We are all equal in the sight of the Lord. Whatever the logic or the theology was, they often set up worker cooperatives, making the goods and services they needed, as in the Shaker community in the United States, or making jams for sale in the market, as various orders in the Roman Catholic Church have done, and so on. So they've existed for a long time, and they exist today in the United States, in many other countries. The most famous example is, of course, the Mondragon Corporation in Spain, which is a family of 250-odd co-ops under one heading that help each other, but that all embody the worker self-directed enterprise as the model of how to organize production. So they've always been there. So we can answer the question, why aren't they there, by first saying, well, they are there. Well, then let's refine the question to what's really on people's minds. Why haven't they been adopted? Why isn't that the way we think normally about production? Why is it necessary for me, for example, to present all of this information so that people understand and can think about and begin to question the status quo in terms of a model that I, for example, believe to be a much better, more humane, and more satisfying way to live and work? Well, the answer is, this model, precisely because it's attractive, precisely because of the virtues it offers that I just gave a partial list of earlier, is a threat to capitalism. It's a threat because it will attract large numbers of people. Imagine for a moment with me, hypothetically, if all the young people coming out of our schools were offered a job choice when they graduate, a choice they do not now have. You can choose to work in a top-down capitalist enterprise. You know, the kind where you're told where to sit and what to do, and someone supervises you, and you come at 8 and you leave at 5, and you have absolutely nothing to do with deciding any aspect of your work life. Versus becoming a part of a workers' co-op, where you will be a decision maker as well as a decision taker all the time, where you will be called upon to be an equal member of a community producing goods, rather than the low man on the pole, as it were, at the bottom of a hierarchy, the top of which you won't ever see or know. Well, you don't need a long time to figure this out. It's safe to say that a significant number of young people will make that choice to work in a workers' co-op, in a workers' self-directed enterprise, because they'd rather do their work that way. They'd rather live their lives with that as the activity they spend 5 out of 7 days performing. They want to be in a democratic work community rather than in an autocratic, undemocratic work community. Therefore, workers would vote with their feet. They wouldn't be available for capitalists to employ because they would have found jobs in a worker self-directed enterprise. So the answer to why we don't see more of them is that every conceivable obstacle, political, legal, financial, has been put in the way of giving worker self-directed enterprise the space in our culture, the space in our economy to show what they're like, to show what they can do, to be an alternative, a real choice people can make as to where they work. The irony is we live in cultures that celebrate capitalism as if it were the paragon example of freedom of choice. But on something as important as the quality of your work life, work is what most people do most of the time in their adult lives. We don't have the choice we could have and we should have, and that's why this first half hour of the program was devoted to an in-depth discussion of worker self-directed enterprises. Please stay with me. We will be back very shortly for the second half of this program, in which we will look at a second and different topic that I also believe responds to many of your communications and in a way continues the discussion of worker self-directed enterprises, but on the larger scale of looking at capitalism in its relationship to socialism. Stay with me. We will be right back. Welcome to the second half of today's program of Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, and in this second half, I'm reminding you again that we're making this experiment to which we would appreciate your responses, of devoting both halves of the program to in-depth conversations about a topic that has been foremost in your minds as per the communications you've sent us. I want to remind you again to use our websites, rdwolfwith2fs.com and democracyatwork.info, to keep in touch with us, to sign up for our newsletters, and make use, literally, of all the work that we regularly update to those websites. In today's second half of the program, I want to talk about capitalisms, with a plural, and socialisms, in a plural. I want to talk about these two things because we live in a time when that's going to become more and more the big issue. Let me explain what I mean. We clearly live in a capitalist economic system. We do that in the Western Europe, North America, Japan, but really on a global basis, if you think about it. But that capitalism is in deep crisis and has been, particularly since 2008, a crisis that's far, far from over. And in the crisis of capitalism, what is happening now is what has happened in previous crises of capitalism. Namely, more and more people are questioning whether capitalism really is the system we want, whether there are alternatives, what the benefits and costs might be of shifting from capitalism to an alternative. Those questions are becoming more and more important to more and more people as the capitalism we're living in delivers fewer and fewer goods to fewer and fewer of our people and makes more and more problems for the majority. So let's take a look at capitalism and its earlier critics, and where socialism fits in on all of this. Well, capitalism is 300 years old, more or less. It arrives in England first. Interesting, but we don't have the time to deal with that today. It arrives in England in the 17th and 18th century, expands to Northern Europe and Western Europe in the 18th century, and becomes a kind of global phenomena in the 19th and 20th century, spreading to North America, to Japan, and eventually everywhere in the world. From the beginning, capitalism has had, and there's no surprise here at all, capitalism has had its critics, people who didn't like it. This isn't surprising. Every other economic system that we know of in the history of the world has likewise had its critics. Feudalism had the people who didn't like it, slavery had the people who didn't like it, and so on. Usually these were people who were victims of these systems in the sense that the systems didn't work well for them, or who were critics who felt that the human race could do better than that system and thought about that and often acted politically about that. So the critics of capitalism are part of capitalism, just like the critics of the other systems were. In the 19th century, the critical impulses around capitalism's emerging and spreading around the world gathered together around the word socialism. They called themselves increasingly socialists, and they criticized capitalism for being an individualist system. Individualism, for them, was capitalism. Community-mindedness, or socialism, was their alternative. They wanted the economy to serve society as a whole and not to enrich a relatively small number of individuals. That was the idea that kind of brought them together. But as capitalism spread, in effect, it also spread its own critics. And that's, again, normal. That's how economic systems work. As they grow and spread, they likewise give rise to growing numbers and growing sophistication of their critics. So socialism was the self-criticism, if you like, of capitalism. If capitalism grew and spread, so would socialism, and that's indeed what happened. As the socialists grew in number, in global spread, in the variety of cultures that enriched that kind of critical thinking in relationship to capitalism, the socialists became more sophisticated, just like the capitalists on their side did. And they became numerous enough that there began to be a broad tradition of people who identified themselves as critics of capitalism, people who believed society could organize the economy differently and in a way that was better for everybody, even if it was at the expense of the privileges of a few that were served by capitalism. This was their thinking. They began to ask, how could we accomplish a transition from capitalism to this preferred alternative, socialism? That became an important question for them because they wanted to take a society to another place, a place where the economy served everybody, where everybody had a certain equality in the economic space, where there weren't differences between employers and employees, where we were all together cooperating collectively to produce the goods and services which we then distributed amongst us in a way that respected our diversity and our needs. That kind of thinking was socialist. And it was very different from the capitalist struggle to make an enterprise, to become an employer, to make money, all of that. It's two different ways of imagining how an economic system might work. So the socialists asked themselves, how do we make that transition? And they hit upon an idea which became dominant. The idea was the way to make the transition was to capture the government. What socialists needed to do, they said to themselves, was to take over the government one way or another and then use the government to make the transition, that the government had the power, the resources, the global or at least national reach to make that transition happen, to convert the economy from the individualist capitalist variety to the collectivist or communitarian socialist alternative. But the socialists who agreed that capturing the state was the way to go disagreed on how to do it. And they basically fell into two camps. One camp wanted to get control of the state by means of a revolution. Here's what they had in mind. Their image was the French Revolution. the uprising of the middle classes in France at the end of the 18th century, who deposed the great kings of France with some violence in the French Revolution of 1789, and who controlled the state and used it to end feudalism in France, the system that had existed there for 1,000 years, and to erect in its place capitalism. The people who made the revolution were businesses and small businesses who wanted capitalism. They captured the state in a revolutionary upsurge in 1789, and then used their power over the state to end feudalism, literally take the land from the landowners, and set up and support a capitalist system instead. The revolutionary socialists basically said, that's our model. We think we need to do that too. We need to make a revolution, capture the state, and then use that to make the transition from capitalism to socialism. Other socialists disagreed. And by the way, the disagreements between these two groups could often become very heated and even violent. What did the second group of socialists say? We can't and shouldn't build socialism with revolution, especially not with violent revolution. Rather, the way we capture and win the state should be by evolution, not revolution. We should establish political parties. We should enter the electoral process. We are the majority, the working people are the majority, so it's just a question of time and effort for us to mobilize the mass of people in socialist parties and win the elections and take over the government that way. And then, same as the revolutionary socialists, we will use our control of the government to make the transition from capitalism to socialism. The two sides disagreed. And what happened in the 20th century was very interesting. Some socialists were in fact able to win state power with revolutions. Other socialists were able to win state power with political mobilization, socialist parties, and so on. The ones who took the revolutionary road were Russia, Soviet Union, People's Republic of China, Cuba, and some others. Those who took the evolutionary road were, to take one example, the French. The French. In France today, the Socialist Party controls the presidency, Mr. Hollande, and both houses of the French governmental legislature. The Socialist Party is the dominant political organization in that country. So socialists in France captured the power in an evolutionary way with political parties, whereas socialists in Russia and China did it by means of revolution. In other words, socialists in some places went one way, in other places another way. But notice they all went to capture the state to make the transition. What's really remarkable and has to be understood by everybody who wants to think clearly about this is that once in power, whether by revolution or by evolution, no socialists made the transition. That is, either they could not or they would not use the government in the way they had intended to make the transition. What did they do? Well, let's go through it. And this is not complicated. In the case of the socialists who took power evolutionary-wise, that is like the French or the Germans or the Italians or the Spanish or many others, Swedes and so forth, when they took power, all that they did was to subject capitalism, the capitalism in which they had come to power, to a great deal of government regulation. That is, they left most of the industries in the hands of the private capitalists who already owned and operated the industrial businesses. They left them alone in the sense of owning, operating, and directing their businesses. All they did was to limit them, to pass laws and regulations, taxing them, requiring them to give their employees health insurance or 5-week paid vacations every year, or all the other things that are typical of European socialist governments. Okay? So socialism, in their minds, came to mean government regulation of what is still a private capitalist system. In places like Russia and China, things went a little bit differently. There, the socialists couldn't or wouldn't make the transition to a socialist economy, but they did something different from what the socialists did in the countries where they came to power with evolution. In Russia, China, Cuba, the government took over the enterprises. It didn't leave them in private hands. It took ownership and operation of the enterprises in industry and eventually in much of agriculture as well, and made them into government enterprises. The government directly owned and operated the enterprise. That's something which did not happen in Western Europe to anything like the same degree. So the socialists, in places where revolutions occurred, took over their enterprises. But here comes the important point. They took them over, but they ran them like capitalist enterprises. What do I mean? Instead of a board of directors elected by shareholders, what runs your typical industrial enterprise in the Soviet Union is a tiny group of people, the equivalent of a board of directors, but they're state officials. They're sent into that or put into that position by the Soviet government, by the Soviet Communist Party, and so on. It's still a tiny group of people who make all the decisions, but these are state officials. They're not private individuals. That's why the term state capitalism applies very precisely and accurately to what happened in the Soviet Union, in China, and Cuba, although we're going to have something to say about Cuba because things are different there from what they have been elsewhere. So neither in the socialist parties of the Western Europe, for example, nor in the socialism of the Soviet Union or China, was the capture of the state able to do what the socialists originally in the 19th century had hoped and theorized it would. They did capture the state, these socialists, but they never made the transition. They couldn't. You know, the leader of the Soviet Revolution, Lenin, in the few years he had between the success of the revolution and his dying from a brain tumor, he once made a very famous speech in which he described the Soviet economy that he and his comrades had organized as state capitalism. And he said that was fine and good. He was happy that they had created a state capitalism because, he said, that was an important step on the road to constructing a socialist economy. He was part of that tradition that saw the capture of the state as a means to get socialism, not as the end itself. Very different was the next leader of Russia, Stalin, who one day in late in the 1920s made an equally important declaration. He said, socialism has been achieved in the Soviet Union. But here was the point, and this is so important. The economy he was describing was the same one that Lenin had described. It hadn't changed. The Soviet government still owned and operated industries and owned and operated them much as capitalists had owned and operated them before. They had replaced private boards of directors with state officials and commissioners. So they had state capitalism instead of a private capitalism, but the transition to socialism hadn't been made. But yes, Stalin said, it has been made. Socialism is when the state owns and operates. And here's an irony of ironies. Many people, including those who don't like Stalin, who hate Stalinism and all that, continued ever since to equate state owning things, state running things, as if it were socialism. those people haven't remembered that in the 19th century, the whole point was the state was a means to make a transition. It wasn't the transition itself. So here we are at the, not only at the end of the 20th century, but at the beginning of the 21st, and we have to recognize that socialism hasn't yet been tried. We haven't got there yet. What we have is capitalism privately run and operated, capitalism run and operated by the state, and these are different systems, and they can have very different consequences for people. It's not that, the point is not that they aren't different. They are. They are different from one another. Things go differently if the government runs an enterprise. In the Soviet Union, the government ran the enterprises and it took the profits and provided all kinds of social services to people that they couldn't get in a private capitalism. So that's an important difference. But it's not socialism if you haven't transformed the production process into a community social affair, if you still run it with a tiny group of people at the top. So that's why it is so interesting that at the beginning of the 21st century, right now, as people become more and more disaffected and disillusioned with capitalism, we notice that the disillusion with capitalism is both a disillusion with private capitalism and a disillusion with state capitalism. And we see it everywhere. In 1989, the Soviet Union fell apart. In the period since, the Chinese economy has become, by everyone's standard, at least a lot more capitalistic than before. But if you look historically at it, here's what we have. People who called a regulated private capitalism socialism, like the French. Here, even in the United States, we see it. There are large parts of the United States that think that when President Obama pushes the Affordable Care Act through, we have socialism because the government is doing something. The government is regulating. The government is controlling. That's a way of thinking about socialism that's quite similar to what you have in Western Europe when the government controls and regulates, even though private capitalists own and operate all the key enterprises in this society. Capitalists own all the key medical companies, all the key medical institutions in our society. The government is regulating and assisting them, but it leaves it in private hands. Yet people are more and more pulling away from this regulated capitalism because it doesn't work. The regulations can be manipulated, withdrawn, watered down, etc. So people have become disillusioned with the state capitalism of Russia, China, and so on that called itself socialism. They've become disillusioned in Europe with the socialist parties and those socialist governments because they haven't really helped working people the way they once did. They weren't even able to protect social democracy the way the Democrats weren't able to protect the New Deal in this country either. So all the people who call themselves socialists are in a kind of fog and a kind of being rejected by the very people they hope to persuade. My final point. Now we can see why there's such a surge of interest in co-ops, in workers getting together, in communities seizing a park like Zuccotti Park, or that park in the middle of Istanbul around which the Turkish struggles happened, or etc., etc., etc. We can see why co-ops, why worker self-directed enterprises, why the Mondragon Corporation in Spain is becoming an important image. It's people having come full circle to what the 19th century once said. Socialism is a fundamentally different way of organizing the production of goods and services that we spend most of our adult lives doing. A socialism that deserves the name has to go beyond both a private regulated capitalism and what it was called in Europe, or a state capitalism, what it was called in Russia and China, to become finally what the whole idea really was at the beginning, a radical transformation in our work lives and through that in our lives as a whole. I hope you found this long and detailed conversation about capitalisms and socialisms of interest. Please let us know what you think. Make use of our websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Sign up for our newsletter. Let us know if you would like us to speak in your area, if you have contacts for new radio stations to carry this program. Click on the Facebook and Twitter icons to follow us that way. I want to thank truthout.org, that independent source of news and analysis, and ask you to check them out. And finally, to thank you for patronizing this program, for listening, for making use of it, for partnering with us. I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Time now, baby, but after a while, gonna be my time, baby, thing gonna change, 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 change.